Let's take out our bulletins this morning. You can look in here in the middle where we have our notes and follow along as we go through the scriptures this morning. We're in the book of Exodus, chapter 18 this morning. And we're dealing with in-laws. Sounds good, doesn't it? Hey, I love that subject, in-laws. And I don't know why it is that people have problems with in-laws. I just don't, boy, I'm an in-law and I'm doing good. Hey. Anyhow, there's some insights here that I think are helpful. And it really doesn't deal as much with the whole subject of in-laws, but it's there, but it's not the main thrust of this portion of Scripture. So let's take a look here this morning and read together chapter 18. We're going to do the first 12 verses. It says, "Now Jethro, the priest of Midian and father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God had done for Moses and for his people Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. After Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her and her two sons. One son was named Gershom, for Moses said, 'I have become an alien in a foreign land.' And the other was named Eliezer, for he said, 'My father's God was my helper. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh.' Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the desert, where he was camped near the mountain of God. And Jethro had sent word to him, 'I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons.' So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. They greeted each other and then went on into the tent. Now Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about all the hardships they had met along the way and how the Lord had saved them. Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hand of the Egyptians. He said, 'Praise be to the Lord, who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who rescued the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly.' And then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God." Now, last chapter, we were talking about the Amalekites and how they attacked Israel, and how through prayer and God intervening in a miraculous way through the fighting of the Israelites, who were amateurs compared to the Amalekites, and God delivered Israel from that attack, from that strong nation. And then we move into this situation. Now they're camped close to Rephidim, near the mountain of God, which we'll see in chapter 20. It's where God comes down and delivers the Ten Commandments. So it'll be quite spectacular here. But right now we find that they've settled in the desert, and word has traveled. Word has spread that something amazing has happened in Egypt, something they've never heard of before. And reports have come back all the way to Midian that the Egyptians have been humiliated, and that a nation has escaped from the middle of Egypt, a people called Israel. And they have fled that place after having their God having decimated the most powerful nation in the world at that time, and they are free. And so, of course, Jethro knew that Moses had gone to Egypt to see how his people were doing, and that he had met this God. He met this God in the desert, right near the same place where he was today. And he saw him in a bush. Kind of strange, but okay. And he told his father-in-law, you know, about this God, and he's going to go down to Egypt and some things. And I'm sure that he was a little piqued in his interest about this God that is coming on the scene, who's in the desert, and this bush burns up and doesn't, is burning but doesn't burn up, and the things that he says and so on and so forth. But you don't see him going, gee, I want to be a follower of this bush God. You know, you don't see any of that. He's a priest of his people, the Midianites. And he took in Moses when he was at his worst. And his daughter married him, and they had two sons. And so now there's this reunion taking place, and you see this relationship of Moses and his father-in-law. And it was really a really great relationship that I think, because of Moses and the way he handled things and the way the character of Jethro, they had a great relationship. Now, I was looking at this and I thought, well, what does this say about Moses? And you see in this story how he made an impact or impression on his father-in-law. So I thought we'll take a look at this and see how. The first point, how do I make a positive impression for the Lord? How do I make a positive impression for the Lord? And one of the things I think from this is that you need to remember they have seen your good and your bad days, especially family. You know, you got family who don't know the Lord, and they've seen you at your worst, and they've seen you at your best, and a lot of times when we become Christians, a lot of people when they become Christians, they become, all of a sudden, they're really good. And they're ready to reform you. And especially a lot of times when children get saved and then they go to their parents, then they just want them to shape up and become Christians right now, you know. And that goes over really good. So the thing to remember, especially when you're dealing with friends and people are close to you, and family, is remember that they've seen you, they know who you are. You can't fool them with now some kind of religious talk or some kind of spiritual thing. They're not impressed by that. They see who you are. And the fact is that Jethro saw Moses at his worst and at his best. Now, how do we know that? Well, here's the thing about these people in those days. In those ancient times, when you had a child, many times that child would get a name based on what was going on in your life at that time. And so we find that Moses had named his sons. And interesting that he named his sons, first one was Gershon, which means basically, I'm an alien, I'm homeless, I'm lost, you know, I'm depressed, I'm discouraged, how did I get to here from where I was? I was the prince of Egypt, and now I'm in a desert in a place taking care of sheep. Oh, I'm an alien. I don't feel at home here. Well, that's his name. Later on in time, because obviously Moses was here for a while, I think it was close to 40 years, he was a shepherd of the sheep of Jethro. And then we have his second son's name, which is Eliezer. And he says, now, my father's God was my helper, and he saved me from the sword of Pharaoh. Now he starts to see the whole point, some of the points of why he's there, how God had delivered him from being killed, and his life is looking up. He's been in the desert for a while, and his life is now starting to come back together. His relationship with the Lord is stronger. He's had time to think about what's going on, and the Lord speak to him. He's met the Lord in the desert, and God has revealed himself, so he's named his son Eliezer, which is kind of positive. So you see the good and the bad. He's seen him when he was down, and now he's positive and he's up, and he's a very strong individual, and it's really positive. So, and you see this in Scripture. Here's a couple verses to look at. Genesis chapter 29, and this is very typical in the Old Testament. Verses 32 through 34, you might want to write that down. And it's the wife of Jacob, his first wife. And her name was Leah, if you remember our study. And she named her children. Now listen to these names here. And Leah became pregnant and bore a son and named him Reuben. See, a son. That's what it means. For she said, because the Lord has seen my humiliation and affliction, and now my husband will love me. Verse 33, Leah became pregnant again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard I am despised, he has given me this son also. And she named him Simeon, which means God hears. And she became pregnant again and bore a son and said, Now this time will my husband be a companion to me, for I have borne him three sons. Therefore, he was named Levi, companion. I'm so glad we don't do it that way now. Can you imagine something you're going through? You know, I got a flat tire, so I called him Flat, or whatever, you know. Whatever thing you're going through at the time, you got that kind of name, would just be so weird. Can you imagine when your kids were born what you were going through at the time? If you can imagine what name they would have, they would go, I hope they had a good time when they were born here. But anyhow, so we find that through this we see that he sees the flaws, he sees the strengths, he sees his good times, and he sees his bad times. And so Moses is not trying to be something he's not. He is who he is, and he's transparent in that, and he's humble in that he doesn't see himself better than his father-in-law. He has an attitude toward him, of which we'll see here a little bit later, more love and respect. And so I think that's a very important thing to recognize, is that they see who you really are, and that your faith is integrated into who you are, and you're not something now is different as far as you're still the same person. It's kind of like this. Someone said this, Christians are not better than non-Christians. People of faith are not any superior to others. All they are beggars who have found where the food is, and they are sharing where they found it. It has nothing to do with who they are, so they're better than anybody, because the Bible does say this, we're all sinners. And sometimes we forget that. We think we're better. And I don't know, sometimes Christians have this desire to straighten people out and fix people. And how many have had really good success with that? We don't. And it's kind of like some people who are not believers, they get the feeling that Christians, all they want is to fix them or to tell them how to live or how to behave, etc., etc. And I tell you, that's just not very attractive. And it doesn't really build a good rapport when you have that type of attitude. So we don't see that here with Moses at all. In fact, we find that he's treating his father-in-law with love and respect. Love and respect. Notice that he bows down to him. Now, when you're the leader of a nation, and estimated there was like 2 million people that in Israel at this time, and you're the leader of all these people, and God has spoken to you directly, and he gives you messages, and he gives you information, and he does incredible miracles through your ministry and through your life, and he's basically through you and your ministry has humiliated the most powerful nation in the world, and you're the leader. Well, if you're in that kind of situation, what would normally happen in that kind of culture would be, you don't go out and meet visitors. They come on your terms. They come and They bow down before you and they show you respect because you're the leader. But what do we find here? Just the opposite. Moses goes out and meets his father-in-law and bows down to him and gives him a kiss. And, you know, in the Middle East, they do that kind of thing. I'm more of a handshake guy. But that's how they would show their respect and their affection. And then he would invite them to come into your home. You'd ask them, you know, how you're doing, what's going on with your life, etc. And you'd have something to drink, some tea or something, or some other things, snacks or little bits to, you know, snack on. And you'd share and talk and get up on the latest news, etc. So you see this kind of this rapport that Moses has with his father. It's a warmth and affection and respect for his father-in-law that's being communicated here. Now, the thing that I think the principle I want to look at here is that we need to show people we're trying to influence, show them love and respect. And that's not easy. Because sometimes you don't respect them, what they're doing with their life. Or the things that they are doing and the things they've done, you don't respect that. So how do you respect the person when they live that way or do those things? Good question. It's not easy. What you have to do is go back to the beginning and say, you know what? Number one, again, I'm a sinner and they are a sinner. And before God, I'm not better. Number two, they're a creation of God. I should treat them as someone that God has put a lot of time and effort into and created. They deserve respect in that respect. And I should love them because Jesus has commanded us to do as he does. Love. It's the command that he asks us to practice with our enemies and with those that are neighbors, those that we come in contact with. So all that is basically, you're changing your perspective on yourself and looking toward them and to show them love. How you can, one way to love someone is to serve them, meet their needs, to looking for some way you can help them, some way you can meet their needs, some way that you can be a blessing to them, and show interest in them, think about them, pray for them, and it opens the door. When you have love for others, it opens the door. I remember years ago, a man and his family came to our church, and he worked with me for a period of time. His name is Simon. What was the first name? Ron. Ron Simon. And he had more people at his funeral. We had people wanting to share what he meant to them. And I had to say, I'm sorry, we can only do 12. Because we've designated certain friends of his for lifelong friends and people that are in his family, relatives, etc. They're going to share what they feel. We had have an open mic. You know, do that sometimes at funerals. We would be here until 3-4 days. That's too long. It was just packed with people. But I said, you could share with others around you what he meant to you. Because he touched so many people's lives, and he loved everyone and showed love for everyone. It was a tremendous impact and opened people's eyes, and it was a great opening for the Lord to speak into their life. And it was wonderful. And we see this in the Lord's life too. He welcomed everyone. Talk about notorious people that most people would avoid. Zacchaeus, that small tax collector, he invited him to have dinner. That was scandalous, because just by associating with him, he rubbed off on you and ruined your reputation. But Jesus didn't care. He looked at that man and said, there's a person in there that is hungry. And it's hard to see past the surface, you know, to see below the surface and say, what is going on in that person's life and what does God want to do in their life? And so that's what we find here in this, is that Moses had an openness to his father-in-law, even though he was a priest of a pagan god. Now, another thing he did that I think is important in impacting people's lives is that he shared what the Lord had done for him or for his people. We see this in verse 8. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about all the hardships they had met along the way and how the Lord had saved them. Now, notice that he says here, he shared with his father everything the Lord had done. So basically, the first part of Exodus, he went through the whole thing. How the circumstances that he went through, how when he first arrived, the Lord told him to do some things, and he talked to the people who were in leadership. He threw down his staff, and it became a snake, et cetera, et cetera, and won their approval. And he said, now I'm going to go talk to Pharaoh and say, let my people go. So he does that, and what happens? Pharaoh said, forget it. And you remember the story. He had them continue to make bricks as slaves without any straw. It just made their work harder, made them more miserable. And the leaders basically turned on him and said, your help we don't need. Please, don't help us anymore to get out of here. And you find this kind of a theme through this, how the people, even though Moses had served them and helped them and done all kinds of things for them, you find them turning against him from time to time and blaming him and wanting to stone him even. So all these things he's gone through, and then all the miracles that God did in turning that whole thing around and humbling Pharaoh, even though Pharaoh resisted all this time, and then going and being in the desert and having no water, and then God gives him water, having no food, and then God miraculously provides them food, having been attacked by a nation that's much more powerful than them and defeating them, one thing after another, so that he sees something here that is opens his heart to what God is like, how God deals with his people, how God treats his people, how God is righteous, how God is good, how God is powerful. All these things are starting to come out in what he is sharing. So, in verse 10, his response to this story of what God has done, he said, praise be to the Lord. Now, that word Lord is capitalized, it's small caps. So, that, of course, that means that's the name Jehovah or Yahweh, the proper name of God. It says, praise be to Yahweh who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who rescued the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now, verse 11, now I know. Now, what does that mean, now I know? He didn't know before. He wasn't sure. He had questions. He had doubts about this God of Moses. But now that he's heard all these things, and he's heard the story, he's heard the things that have been done, now he knows that this is the true God. This is the only God. This is the God above all gods. And so it got below the surface. Now, here's the thing. Sometimes we just have to let people see us as we are so that it's not always, and this happens in churches a lot. So how's it going? Praise the Lord. I'm doing great. Couldn't be better. Okay, see you later. And then that's who they really are. The frown comes on. But when they're around Christians, they're praise God, glory be, or all these little phrases that you might use to cover up. Because a Christian is supposed to be full of faith and victory and positive and powerful, right? That means you're a good Christian. well, that's a phony Christian. Because Christians are like people everywhere. We have good days, bad days, struggles, hardships. All those things are real. They happen to us too. So how can someone relate to you if you're always like, this is a bad thing? How can you relate to anybody like that? You just can't. They're just something really strange. I don't know what happened to them. I don't think it's drugs, but it could be. They're just not real. And you have no way to relate to them. But when you are able to be real with people and say, yeah, I'm really struggling right now. My finances are, I don't know what happened, but I miscalculated my taxes. And I got a huge bill. And I got, everything's tapped out. And my boss says they can't keep me. And I just, I'm a little overwhelmed right now. And I'm just trusting God to help me because I don't know what to do. Now, is that a great testimony? Yeah. Why? Because you're being real. You have a relationship with God, and this is how you live life. You live life every day with God, through your good times and through your bad times. And they watch you. They go, I had a problem like that. I almost lost my marriage. I wonder how he's going to do. And they watch you go through this, navigate this, and see how God helps you to deal with these problems and these circumstances, and eventually how God answers your prayer and how God brings you through it and out of it. Now it becomes, wow, this is real. I can relate to that a little bit. And as I see your times when things miraculously happen, fantastic things happen, blessings happen, hardships happen, trials happen, sickness, conflicts, all kinds of things that we go through as Christians. And they see how you deal with it with God and how God is working in your life, how God works in your life, and how he helps you to be able to handle the stress of it, the hardship of it. God starts to become real. And a lot of times that's the questions they ask. Is this a real God? Not, I have some philosophical questions. Most people don't have those. There are a few that do, but most people don't. Most people want to know if God is real and if he can help them. And to see that in your life and see the difference that he makes in your life opens the door to have an impact on their life. Now, Jethro, eventually he offers sacrifices to God. He worships God. He eats with the elders of Israel, which is a big deal in that culture. Eating with people was a big deal. It said something that because you ate together, you are connected to each other. Somehow by eating, you connect yourself with another person, other people. And that's why in the New Testament, you see these Pharisees saying, nope, we can't eat here because somebody who's Gentile touched that and unclean. And they would have nothing to do with you if you were a Gentile. If you weren't a religious person of a Jewish descent, they wouldn't have anything to do with you because eating would then bring that sin and that corruption on you. So they wouldn't do it. So there's something big here happening where the people in leadership of the nation, Moses and all the elders and Aaron and the priest that would become into the situation, all ate with him and before the presence of God, it says. So whether or not there's two ways to look at this. You can look at that. That was the moment. That was the time when Jethro became a believer. When Jethro started to follow Yahweh, became a follower of God. Or you can say he was a man who was became an interested observer, so to speak. Because we don't see a whole lot more on when the people of Israel went into the Promised Land. Moses, I forget, I think it's a number somewhere, he invited his father-in-law to join them. and to come into the promised land with them. And Jethro said no. That doesn't mean he wasn't a believer. I just don't know. There's not enough, to me, it's not enough evidence to take one side or the other, but it is interesting the impact that Moses had on his life. Now, here we go into verse 13. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. And when his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" And Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws." And Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you are doing is not good. You and these people who came to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them the decrees and laws, and show them the way to live and the duties they are to perform. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over the thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times. But have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. And that will make your load lighter, because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied." And Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said, and he chose capable men from all of Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, and they served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. And then Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country. Okay, so here we got a situation here where Moses obviously feels a great responsibility to lead his people, to teach his people, to guide his people of how to follow and how to walk with God, how to live by God's will. And the people were interested in that. They want to know what God's will in situations were, or what God would say about certain situations and circumstances. Now, this would be more codified in chapter 20 when God gives the law and instructions on about the law. But at this time, they don't have all that. And so they're going to Moses on everything. And if you can just see this, there's a line a mile long, literally, of people waiting to see Moses. It's 6 a.m, the sun's there, and there's Omed and his wife, wanting to talk to Moses about this situation. What does God say about this? And we have a conflict with these people, and what do we do about this kind of thing? And what does God say about? And it goes on all day for 12, 14 hours. Can you imagine anything more draining than listening to people's problems all day? And having to decide who's right and who's wrong, who's this and who's that, and what do we do, and how to handle this, all day, every day. Talk about get worn out. I know he's a young 80, but gee whiz, this is going to kill you. You're not going to be able to hold up under this strain. And so when his father-in-law sees this, and he's a pretty bold man, he has a lot of courage to tell the leader of a nation that you're messing up here. This is not good. Your plan of how to help the people is not the way to do it. This is not a good idea. So he gives them counsel about how to set up a judicial system that would be led by men that are competent, that are trustworthy, that everybody respects, and they know how, because they've been trained how to deal with these problems, and they'll answer and deal with these issues. And now, instead of waiting 6 months to be heard, you can just go to the judge. He's right down the street. That's the guy. That's, you know, Joseph over there, and he's gonna. Let's go to him and ask him what does God say about these kind of things. And if it's too difficult, you move it up the scale to the next one, until eventually, if it's too difficult for anybody, then it goes to Moses, and he gives the God's will and what the situation is and what how to decide it. So therefore, you don't have people worn out waiting. DMV to the infinite degree. Number 5,064. Oh, man, I'm 28,000. Gee whiz, I'm going to be here for 5 weeks. You don't have that kind of just strain. Everybody is now served, and the people are ministered to, because it was just too much for Moses to do. He couldn't handle all of that on his own. And so he felt a responsibility to give him the right answer, but this is not the way to meet that need. So here's the thing. Some good advice on how to spend your time. Because we all have situations where we find ourselves overwhelmed. We're too much. We're doing too much. You know, it's kind of like if you ever work in a situation where you have a certain set of responsibilities, and as time goes on, your job description continues to grow. You're adding more things you got to do, more things you got to do, and you're looking to do this and do that, and you're going, you know, I can't work more efficiently. I'm doing all I can do. So what do you do in those kind of situations where you're overwhelmed? Basically, he's saying, here's the thing. You need to, first of all, ask yourself, what are my priorities? What are your priorities? What are the important things? Now, for Moses, yes, he was doing something that was very important, but it was not the most important thing. Some of these things that he was doing could be done by others. So he's basically giving him advice, saying, you need to pass this on. You can't do everything. And because you can't do everything, you need to find out what is your priority, what you can do. And the other things, either have, which we'll talk about a bit in a minute, pass it on or not do it. Because when you do this, when you take on more than you need, than you can really handle, it affects so many things. It affects your health. It affects your relationships. Some people have lost their marriages, had a strange relationship with their children because they're workaholics. They're constantly doing things more and more and more. And you lose touch with what's important, and you're just overwhelmed. And your life is a constant just trying to keep your head above water. When I was young, we had a church that was growing very fast. And I didn't have a whole lot of experience on things. And the way that things were done is that the pastor would say, we need this done. You do it. So he'd say, Roger, we need someone to head up the Sunday school. I said, okay. So next Sunday, you're in charge. God bless. Kids, do they come on Sundays? You know, I didn't know. I went to Sunday school when I was a kid, but so I had to find out how to do it and what to do and learn how to be put this thing together. And it was growing so fast that I was just overwhelmed. So I had to find people to help me and recruit them and train them. That was basically what I was doing for the most of the time, is just recruiting and training people to help with the load. Now, here's the thing. Sometimes we like being busy. Sometimes We feel important being busy. And I was like that a little bit. I kind of liked being busy. I had people to meet, things to do, blah, 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 very important, too, blah, blah, blah. But after a couple of years of that, I didn't care to be important anymore. I was so tired, I didn't care. I was burnt out on that, you know. I didn't want to be important. I didn't want to be busy. I wanted to pass this on and let other people take ownership of things and be a part of things and do things. And so you see that Moses was willing to just give this up. It didn't matter to him that others would be doing this, because he wanted to make sure that the needs were met, and this made sense to him because the needs were not being met the way he was doing things. Now, in asking yourself what is your priorities, his priority was sharing and teaching the Word of God and teaching the people the ways of God. And in parallel, in the book of Acts, chapter 6, you see the same thing happening there, where the apostles, if you remember the story, the apostles had a controversy. There were different Jewish people who had come to the Lord from all over the world. You had the Greeks, and then you had the natives there of Israel and the other groups. And they had a program they had put together to help the widows with food and different things. Well, the Greeks thought they were being left out because the local Jews who'd come to the Lord kind of overlooked them, maybe because they were Greeks and they were different, and so on and so forth. So there was this controversy here and a problem of how to equally meet these needs. So they go to the apostles and say, "We need help. You need to solve this." And the apostle says, "No, if we do that, we'll neglect what we really are supposed to do, which is to pray and to teach the Word of God. That's what our main responsibility is as apostles. That's what we need to do. So we're going to give this off to some other men, and I want you guys to look among you and give us suggestions of who's men of character, spiritual maturity, people you respect, and very capable men, and appoint them to deal with this." So we have the first deacons dealing with those problems. But it was because the apostles recognized what their priority was, what the most important thing for them to do, because they could have done everything. A lot of times you think you can do everything because you could do everything. You started whatever project you're doing, or if it's a business or some organization you're a part of. You can do everything because you're very capable. And here's another thing. I don't know about you, but sometimes we are perfectionists. Anybody perfectionist in here? Okay, I don't see anybody. All right, there we go. So what happens with perfectionists? "I don't like the way they do that. They don't do that very good. I don't want to say that, but I could do a lot better and quicker." And you find them just busy doing everything. And it's hard because they have a hard time letting go of things. But the fact is that you multiply your effectiveness if you're able to train people and give that away and let people learn and grow into that responsibility. And you'll find that sometimes they do it better than you. "Oh, that's hard to take." But they can. So you have to ask yourself, where can you delegate? Where can you delegate? Where do I need to replicate myself? Where do I need to replicate myself so that the need or the mission that I'm involved in, whatever, is met and dealt with? And that's the principle that Moses was exercising here. He was looking for men, looking for people that he could delegate this to so that he could reproduce himself, basically replicate himself, and be more efficient in meeting the needs of the people. So, who should you pick to share this load? Now, this is more dealing with, again, dealing with the court system of Israel. It also has some spiritual connotations to how you deal with ministry and picking people. But there's some, I think, some universal things here, too, that are important to keep in mind. And here's some of the things he mentions. Someone who is capable of doing the task. Well, duh. But sometimes you don't know. You know, they look very, they speak well. They handle themselves pretty good. Well, they could do this. Hey, why don't you do this? And then you find out, oh boy, they are not good at that. They're so disorganized, they couldn't even organize their own bedroom. This is not a good idea to give them this responsibility. But you don't know that sometimes at the beginning. So check it out. Find out what their capabilities are, what their talents are, what they're good at. And those are the people that you pass it on to. Because everybody has capabilities. Everybody has talents. Everybody has things that, gifts that God has given them. And those are the things you look for when you're looking for people and you know what you have need to be done and you're looking for those kind of people to meet those needs. Because some people are really good at some things and do it very naturally because God gifted them that way. Other people, not going to happen. I remember in church, several people wanting to volunteer to lead worship. And I thought, well, you know what? First you have to be able to sing. And I don't think this is going to work for you. You know? People are going to be distracted by your voice. And they're not going to be able to worship God because they're thinking, well, that was off. Oh, that's really... it's not going to work. Or someone who is supposed to be managing things. Some people have ability to manage things, to organize things, to make things run smoothly. My wife's that way. She's good at organizing things and making things go smoother. And it's just amazing. People have those gifts. And other people have an ability to make people feel comfortable and welcome and feel, you know, appreciated, etc. They just have a natural warmth about them. Then there's others. Oh, better not put them out front. People are going to, what? Let's get out of here. This person's, I don't know, he looks like a mass murderer. I'm not sure. So you have to be aware of their gifts and talents and select the people that are capable of doing the task at hand. Here's another one. Someone who fears God. Someone who fears God. In other words, this is implied here that they have a relationship with God and a sense of awe and respect for God, that God is the most important thing. He is the most important thing. Now, why would that be important in this situation where you're dealing with people who are going to dispense justice? When you fear God and you have this respect for God, you're not intimidated by other people who have maybe a position of power or position of popularity or some kind of something that would intimidate somebody. You need a judge that's not going to be intimidated by the people in front of him. Because if he is, then he's going to be influenced and try to please that person or these people, this group, and that's just what you don't need. You need someone who's not going to be favorites because they feel intimidated by this group or that person or that situation. So you need someone who has a fear of God. Another thing about this fear of God and respect for God, it means that you respect people. In other words, the little guy. You have as much respect for the little guy as you do for the powerful people. And you need that as a judge to be able to be not a respecter of persons. And that comes from having respect for God. So that God is the most important thing, and you care what he thinks more than what you think, what other people think. Another thing about fear is that we remember in the book of Proverbs, it says fear, the fear of the Lord, is the beginning of, what's the word? Wisdom. Wisdom. How many think you need wisdom if you're judging people's situations? Yes, obviously. So a person who has the fear of God, they have the workings and the beginnings of gaining wisdom. and being able to deal with the situations that are at hand. They can see things that people who do not have wisdom don't see. Now, this is different than intelligence. You can have people who are very intelligent and are fools. Then they have no wisdom. So intelligence and wisdom are not the same thing. So you have a person who has wisdom is able to make decisions that have, they see the long-term consequences of things. They see things, how cause and effect work, and how this decision or these things will affect things, and they know what to do so that these things will go to a certain place that will be right. Does that make any sense? So they see things that other people don't see, and this wisdom enables them to see through the fog and see to the heart of the matter and see what really needs to be dealt with. Case in point, Solomon, when he was king, he became king, and he was given a case of two women. And they came and were disputing over the fact that this child that they had belonged to them and not the other. And they both disputed who was the real mother of this child. Remember that situation? And no one could figure it out because they both were like, look so sincere. They both had passion about this baby, and it's like, and they both gave a good accounting of themselves why this is their child. And when you look at the child and you go, oh, yeah, it looks a little bit, yeah, it could be the way. I don't know what to do. And what did Solomon do? He says, well, let's be fair. Let's cut the baby in half. That was stupid. Don't do that. You know, and the woman going, no, no, hey, don't do that. Give her the baby. We don't want to do that. Okay, you're the mother then. Well, how did he know? Well, see, he brought that out. And people just went, that made sense. Well, that's true. That has to be the mother. And the other one said, yeah, go ahead. Cut it in half and we'll split her up. He knew that a mother would react. And he kind of knew with this woman how she was going to react. How did he know? Sometimes you ever meet people and you go, how did they know that? They're wise. They had wisdom. So you need someone who has wisdom. And sometimes if you have people that are working for you, you definitely want to have someone who's wise. Someone has wisdom. That you don't have to describe every single situation and how to handle it. Otherwise, it's going to blow up the whole office. You know, some people are wise. They can deal with situations, and they know how to navigate with people and their situation, the problem, and how to make. They know how to do that. And you go, where did you learn that? They're just very wise in dealing with those kind of situations. So anyhow, wisdom and fear of God go together, and as one of those qualities that you want to have. Another thing here, he mentions someone who is trustworthy. Someone who is trustworthy. Okay? Now, what is trustworthy? They're worthy of your trust. In other words, you can count on them. And it's amazing in our society how many people you can't count on. They say, yeah, we'll be there. They're not here. What happened? Call them up. Oh, I'm on my way. What do you mean, on your way? That was yesterday. Okay, I'll give you another chance. Oh, something came up. My car got broke into, and blah, blah, blah. And you can't. They have an excuse ready at the ready on everything. You go, not trustworthy. Here's an important principle. Don't believe what people say. Watch what they do. Because people are good at, people are really good at presenting themselves and putting a good thing, spin on things, and they look like they're trustworthy, but they never do what they say. They never follow through on a promise. They can't rely on them. It's hit and miss, depends on how they feel at the day or what their priority is, not yours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the people you probably don't want to have involved in, and you can't replicate yourself in them. It's just not going to happen until God gets a hold of them and convicts them of it and changes them. So you want someone who's going to follow through on what you have told them so that you don't have to monitor them, follow them around, and make sure they're doing it, constantly checking on them, and et cetera. That's not more efficient. That just weighs you down. And finally, someone who isn't in it for dishonest gain. Now, in this situation, this was very important. You want judges that you can't buy. You can't grease their palms. You can't pay them off to give a certain judgment in your favor. They could not be bought. Money was not what they were about, and no amount of money was going to change their view or cause them to make a different decision. Now, this is very common in a lot of judicial systems of the day. If you are a powerful person, had money, you can get your way, and it's something that's very human. And it's with us today. People who have more money a lot of times get better justice. So when picking someone who's going to be replicating yourself, especially for this judicial situation, you want someone who money is not the issue. You can't buy them. They're people of integrity. Justice is what they're about. And when you have people that are working with you or for you, you don't want somebody who's just in it for the money either. Because that's a central value for them, not whatever your job you're doing or whatever vision you have or whatever mission you have or whatever thing you're doing. It's not about a matter of the money. Because if it's all about the matter of the money, not saying that they shouldn't be compensated, but it's always about when am I going to get a raise? How come he's got more than me? And, I can take a little bit of this and that, and I can feather my hat here and get a little more here. And pretty soon you've got someone who's siphoning off from the register, blah, 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 blah. You don't want any of those kind of things. So, one who fears God, one who's trustworthy, one who isn't in it for unjust gain, and one who is capable. Those are some of the things that we see in this chapter. Let's have the ushers come forward. We're going to have communion this morning.